Senate Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness will come to order. Colleagues, the vice chair is going to be delayed on Senate business temporarily. We're actually going to do a public hearing on HCR 11, HCR 22, and then we're going to reopen a temporary work session on HB 2880 so we can take some more testimony so they can do that. So I'm going to open a public hearing on HCR 11 and 22, if you would please, counsel, and then we'll turn it over to the good representative from the House.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HCR 11 recognizes and honors Sergeant Ronald W. Burkhart, and HCR 22 recognizes and honors Corporal Robert Bobby Leon Jones.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Andy Olson, state representative from the Albany area, and I really do greatly appreciate you listening to House Concurrent Resolution 11. This is in regards to Ronald Wayne Burkhart. His mom is right back there, Grace. And she was not able to make it when we heard this over on the House side. But, I mean, I tell you, it's pretty neat. Michael and Terry Thorpe here, who are Gold Star family parents, brought her up. So it's just kind of fun to have this right now in front of you. And it's truly an honor to be here for you. But I'll just go through this quickly here. Ronald Wayne Burkhart was born on March 4th, 1949, in Harlan, Kentucky. It just so happens he shared his birth date with his mother, Grace. At the age of 13, the Burkhart family moved across the country, settling in Albany, Oregon. During his teen years through junior high and high school, he took up the sport of boxing and became quite good at it, winning numerous matches and trophies. Ron loved the outdoors. He loved fishing and bow hunting, including hunting for antelope in eastern Oregon. At the age of 17, he enlisted in the United States Army, following his older brother's Ron's footsteps. While stationed in Germany, he volunteered for a tour of duty in Vietnam. In Vietnam, he was assigned to the A Company, 3rd Battalion, 7th Infantry Regiment, 199th Light Infantry Brigade. On 26 March 1968, at the age of 19, he was killed in action by enemy fire in Binh Hieu Province, South Vietnam. And, you know, of the 58,300 U.S. servicemen that were killed during that, or that were found missing in action during the Vietnam War, his name can be found on the Vietnam Memorial War Panel 46E, Row 29, Washington, D.C. I don't, Terry, do you want to jump in on that?
Sure. My name is Terry Thorpe, and I'm from Tangent, Oregon. Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you for letting me speak today. This sign has a really personal thing in my heart. I met Grace about 11 years ago when our son was killed. I met her on Memorial Day at a service. We were introduced. And since then, I have spent a number of days talking with her about Ronald. I've gotten to know who he was and who she is as his mother, and listening to her talk about the time of our country back then. Unfortunately, I was a very little girl when the Vietnam War occurred. And so I did not have the opportunity to meet Ronald. I know that what I have heard and what I do know of that era was from history books and from talking with our veterans, our Vietnam veterans. This is a great way to give back to them and to say thank you for what they did. Our country wasn't very nice back then in those days. And as a Gold Star mom in this day and age and watching where our country is, I think this is a really great way to say thank you to Ronald and to put his name out there so that our country doesn't forget what that time of, you know, our country was all about, and to be able to say thank you to him. So I ask that you please vote in favor of this.
Thank you, ma'am.
So following up then, Mr. Chair, just to refresh everybody's memory, in 2015 we passed House Bill 2389, which streamlined the process to obtain a highway memorial sign for fallen heroes. And I tell you, we couldn't have done that without you over here on this side of the building. So I greatly appreciate that. And that has, you've seen more signs pop up. But boy, I mean, it just encourages me to see those signs that people care, you know, when you see them out there on the road. House Concurrent Resolution 22, Corporal Robert Bobby Leon Jones. Bobby Jones was born on September 30th, 1983 in Oregon City. He moved to Milwaukee with his family a little later. He graduated from Rex Putman High School in 2002. He loved life. He loved spending time with his family. In fact, he purchased a computer for his mother while he was overseas to stay in touch with her. He enjoyed camping, hunting, fishing, and listening to music. After graduating from high school, he joined the United States Army because he wanted to serve his country. He was assigned the 40th Engineer Battalion based in Bollenhammer, Germany. Bobby planned to attend college upon returning home and open a business with his brother. Additionally, he wanted to buy a home for his parents. Corporal Burkhart was known for his practical jokes, always displaying a grin. He was good-natured, generous, friendly, and had an ability to make people laugh. But there was a serious side to him as well, which exemplified by his dedication to his family and manner in which he lived out his ideals of duty, honor, and country. While serving in a second tour of duty in Iraq on 17th June 2008, Corporal Robert Jones was killed during combat operations Ramadi when an improvised explosive device detonated near his MV. So with both of these, Mr. Chair and Committee, I would urge you to support those and move them forward.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, ma'am, for your testimony. We don't have anyone else signed up, as is the practice. Representative Olson knows, but for those that are out there, we'll keep the record open till a week from today. So anybody else that wants to submit information for the record on either the House Concurrent Resolution 11 and 22, we'll take that into the record till next week, and then we'll schedule a work session for a week from today, and then we'll pass it out of this chamber to the floor of the Senate. So thank you, and thank you again for coming and testifying before the committee, ma'am.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If you may, for the representative, how do you spell your last name?
Well, backwards, it's no slow. Here's your senator, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson is knee slow.
Thank you, Representative.
Always a comic in the admits. Is there anyone? There's no one else signed up for House Concurrent 11 or House Concurrent Resolution 22. Is there anyone else that wants to testify? If not, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Concurrent Resolution 11 and 22, and we're going to go back. Thank you very much. We're going to go back, and we're going to open up a work session for the purpose of taking additional testimony on House Bill 2880. If you would, counsel, very quickly, and I'll ask Mr. Calhoun to come forward.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2880 was heard on the 2nd of March. It expands the definition of public buildings for purposes of displaying the Oregon State flag and the National League of Families, POW/MIA flags, alongside the nation's flag, to include county, municipal, school district, and special district buildings where it is usual and customary to display the flag. There is a minimal fiscal and no revenue impact, and there is a dash one amendment. The members will recall testimony from special districts and League of Cities concerned about having to retrofit buildings to have appropriate flag poles that would support. Mm-hmm. So the dash one amendment gives them a prospective date for newly constructed buildings rather than the date that's in the existing law.
We're all ears. We'll listen to what you have to say.
Chair Boquist, Senator Courtney, my name is John Calhoun. I'm a resident of Southwest Portland. I'm here today in opposition to HB 2880. I'm here on my own behalf, but I believe I represent many Vietnam veterans who do not support this bill. First, though, I would like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to testify today since the hearing was last week and I was out of town, so I really appreciate that. I served in Vietnam during 1969 and 1970, where I was an artillery officer in the 1st Infantry Division and later the 2nd Field Force. I spent time on combat patrols with the infantry as a forward observer and at fire bases as a fire direction officer and battery executive officer. I participated in the Cambodian invasion 47 years ago this month. I was awarded 2 Bronze Stars for my service. The POW flag does not represent me. I've always found this flag to be disturbing. It was created in 1971 when there were still prisoners of war in Hanoi. But once the prisoners were returned in 1973, the flag was then exploited by people who could not accept an end to the war. They created a myth that the government had betrayed our soldiers and left prisoners behind, just as it had betrayed the military by not conducting the war more aggressively. We would have won the war if we hadn't been betrayed, they claimed. The activists behind this flag held up normalization with Vietnam and made life difficult for Senators Kerry and McCain, who were trying to reestablish relations with Vietnam and actually figure out what happened to the MIAs. Long after it was clear that there were no POWs left behind, the activists kept claiming there were. Over time, the flag became a symbol of defiance against the government. While I oppose this, I recognize that for many, including many Vietnam vets, the flag represents a pledge that the military will not leave any of its members behind in combat. However, I think you should think about the precedent you are setting by mandating that one group's flag be flown at all public buildings, even if we acknowledge that many veterans support this action. While it may be appropriate in an American Legion Hall, why is it appropriate at a public library, fire station, or school building? It is, after all, a military symbol. Should we also fly a peace flag for those who have a different view? Should we fly the rainbow flag to honor our diversity? Why should the state of Oregon require any flag be flown beyond the state flag? How are you going to respond when another group makes an impassioned request that their flag also be mandated for public buildings? Flying this flag at schools is especially troublesome. The flag itself is stark and dark. Do you want elementary school children seeing this daily? Will parents be upset when they find this must be flown at their school? When you debate the buildings that should be required to do this, I think you should take special caution about the public schools. It also does not represent all veterans. We suffered 58,000 deaths in Vietnam, 150,000 wounded, and 2.5 million served. But only 1,600 are missing in action, and fewer than 800 were ever held prisoner. How does this flag represent the rest of us? I have a friend who submitted testimony, who was in the Marines during that time. His brother served in Vietnam, was awarded the Silver Star for heroism during the battle at Wake City in 68. He was killed in that action. How does this honor him? In spite of my concerns, I support our military and my fellow vets. I just believe that there are better ways to honor them and us, and I'm hoping the committee will not support this bill. Thank you again for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. With that, we're going to close the work session on HB 2880. Colleagues, we're going to recess and then reconvene at 3:30 in the hearing room behind us for a joint hearing with the House Committee in regards to informational meeting in regards to the Titan Fusion Center, and then the bills that we have will carry forward till next week. So we're going to recess and then reconvene next door in
hearing room A.
Hearing room A. With that.
Off two senators.
It's
amazing, isn't it?
The May 9th House Committee on Veterans and Emergency Preparedness is now open. We're going to have a public hearing on the Titan Fusion Center, informational meeting only.
And the Senate committee will reconvene.
Okay. I'm leading. He's not going to help you, evidently.
Mr. Slauson, Shannon Marnheim, and Steve McIntosh, please come forward as a panel or independently if you don't like each other. But we're open as a panel.
We like each other.
That's great. We're looking forward to getting smarter on this. So in whatever order you'd like to proceed, take it away.
Thank you.
Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, committee members, my name is Michael Slauson. I'm an Assistant Attorney General of the Department of Justice. My current assignment is Chief Counsel of the Criminal Justice Division. Seated immediately to my left is Shannon Marhine. She is the Critical Infrastructure Key Resource Program Coordinator for the Titan Fusion Center. Immediately to her left is Steve McIntosh. Mr. McIntosh wears many hats at the Department of Justice. He is an Assistant Special Agent in Charge. He is also the Fusion Center Director. So, and I would like to thank the committee for the opportunity to come here today to talk to you about the Fusion Center. And we prepared a PowerPoint presentation for your consideration, but of course we're happy to answer any questions the committee has. We're here at your disposal. So to begin, I thought it would be helpful to start off with a slide to talk a little bit about the Fusion Center's scope. This shows the Fusion Centers, the red dots represent Fusion Centers across the United States. I think Wyoming is the only state that does not have a Fusion Center. So the Fusion Centers, it's a network, a national network of Fusion Centers was created in response to the 9/11 Commission report. The creation of the National Fusion Center Network recognizes that sharing information effectively across all disciplines, whether it be public or private or state or federal, is essential to our efforts to combat terrorism and to combat crime. Basically, the idea is that you do not want different constituencies, public or private sector, having silos of information. You don't want individual people or groups or entities to have a single puzzle piece. You want them to come together in a manner that they can put all those pieces together and paint the bigger picture so that we can be responsive both nationally, on the state level, and locally to the threats that we face. As the slide points out, there's a total of 78 centers in the United States. They're unique in design, but generally speaking, they operate the same. So sometimes they can have maybe more of a focus on case-related support in criminal investigations, maybe some focus more on specific types of terrorism. It's an FT issue generally, so there's variations, but generally at the heart of it, as we'll be discussing, you'll see a common theme about the Fusion Center is that we really are the nexus to connect all the various partners together so they can create that bigger picture of what Oregon is facing. So you see here on this slide that the primary mission is to aid in the identification, prevention, and disruption of terrorists and criminal threats. That is really essentially what we do is we're in an aid. We are the hub, we are the connectors. I was talking just before this testimony, there's an author named Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called Tipping Point. I don't know if any of you have read that, but one of the things he talks about how a trend becomes so popular and spreads is you need a connector. And that really is what the Fusion Center is. And so here you can see that the Fusion Center locations are...
I have a question real quick, just to make sure that we're clear. The primary mission since 9/11 has been to share information to ensure that bad things don't happen. The secondary mission, or at least perhaps the one that sometimes isn't necessarily always aligned, is to getting information and sharing information in a way that can be used in a court of law, right? You do that to the extent that you can, but ultimately the primary job is to make sure if we can prevent something from happening, we can.
Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, committee members, yes, that's the idea, and that we have, as you're aware, we have certain federal and state laws, be they constitutional or statutory, right, that guide us in how we collect information. And the goal is always to collect information in a way that is lawful. And if we're inside those guideposts, that we should be able to offer that evidence in furtherance of a prosecution. So from this slide, you could see that most, if not with the absence of about 3% across the country, that the Fusion Centers are located in a law enforcement-related facility. It could be like it is in our situation. I should probably just take a step back to explain this. So in the Department of Justice, the division that I head is the Criminal Justice Division. In that division, we're both the prosecutorial and investigative arm of the Attorney General's Office. So we do, as Mr. McIntosh supervises, we do have sworn police officers in our office. So we are a law enforcement agency for most purposes, although there's some kind of tweaks in the statutes periodically. We fall outside of it. For the most part, we are. I thought it'd be helpful to have a slide that kind of discusses maybe the difference between the Fusion Center and the Joint Terrorism Task Force in Portland. So here you can see from the slide, again, kind of getting back to what the theme here is that the point of the Fusion Center is to get information, to be that central hub for information. And then when we get that information, maybe it's somebody out in the field, a police officer who sees some suspicious activity and thinks, I don't know what this means, I'm not really sure, I want the Fusion Center to know about that. Then we get that information, we find the right group to send it on to. Often that might be the JTTF, and then their responsibility as the investigative agency, they're the actors. They're the ones that do something with that information. And another example of that would be, so we'll get kind of further going through the presentation. We do threat assessments of events. It could be the Rose Parade. It could be the Pendleton Roundup. And so, again, we're the ones who kind of give those event organizers, the people responsible, the information about the threats. And then, but they're the actors. They're the ones that actually take that information and do something with it. So similar is the setup here into the different roles. And so you also see a key distinction is that we do all crimes. But a lot of what we do is assisting law enforcement in the apprehension and prosecution of criminals engaged in just common crimes, not necessarily terrorism. And we also address other hazards that might befall us, like Cascadia or other events like that, is all part of our mission. Thought it'd be helpful to talk a little bit about our staffing. Currently, we have 3 limited duration positions that are a part of the Fusion Center. We also have 2 federally funded positions that have specific missions, which I'll talk about during the presentation, that comprise the Fusion Center. Also permanently located there is we have 2 representatives from the Department of Homeland Security. One person is responsible for information sharing with respect to threats and other event awareness. We have another person who's responsible for critical infrastructure. We have several partners that we work with on a part-time or interim basis.
Excuse me, sir.
So I wanted. You said you have 3. You said limited duration positions.
Did Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Representative Lively. Yes, we have currently 3 limited duration positions for
what
the Fusion
is that,
Center.
When you say limited duration, what does it actually mean in relationship to staffing this effort?
So, Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, that means that if it's not funded by this legislative body, then we would not.
Okay.
Not have any of those FTEs after this session. One point of clarification, though, that's kind of interesting about the Fusion Center is that the Fusion Center is a designation, and it was made by former Governor Kitzhaber in 2011, and it's a designation that the Oregon Titan Fusion Center is the Fusion Center for the state of Oregon, and that's why DHS recognizes, the Department of Homeland Security recognizes such and provides us with those resources, which are the 2 people I was mentioning, the person who's responsible for the threat assessments and the information sharing, also person for critical infrastructure. And as we see here on the slide, we have, I mean, this is a point of the Fusion Center. We live and die by your partnerships because you need to get those people outside of their silos. You need to train them to be informed observers, to get that information to us so that then we can share it with the appropriate people. So that's a key component of our function is to reach out, do outreach and to training. Again, it's not just public. It's also private entities because they serve a critical role.
Could you go back to the slide, Councilor?
I hope so. I hope I can.
All right. without naming, obviously, but can you give a broad range of examples of private entities? Not naming institutions, but the types of private entities that are involved in the Fusion Center?
Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, I might defer to Shannon Marhine on that particular question. She might have better examples than I would.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Sorry, I'm shorter than everybody else. Chair Boquist, Chair Evans, members of the committee. Our infrastructure protection program works closely with our private sector partners. And so we have a vast degree of partners from each of the 16 recognized sectors from DHS. Predominantly, our biggest partners right now are utilities. They're the ones that are very active in the infrastructure protection world. We're seeking partners from all the other sectors as well. Water, power, you name it. We have folks that are very, very much involved in the security of the infrastructure. So that's where we work really closely with the DHS PSA that Michael had mentioned earlier.
Well, Representative Escobar is about to ask a question. Could you please again say your name and your title?
Yes, of course. For the record, my name is Shannon Murray, and I'm the Critical Infrastructure Program Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Justice. Thank you.
Now, you mentioned before that you had some badge hearing officers. I see five people up there. How many people are in this center? So I'm seeing three in front of me. Three up there, five up there. I've seen. We're talking about badge carrying officers, and then does the private sector help pay for this?
Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Representative Escobar. So, when I mentioned about the badge officers, so that represents the Criminal Justice Division has sworn law enforcement officers. So. In it that we can work with the Fusion Center, but are not specifically assigned to the Fusion Center. So in terms of the FTE specifically assigned to the center from the Department of Justice, you have the three FTE that we mentioned. We do have outside partners from the National Guard, from DHS, from FBI, the TSA, I think I've mentioned all the acronym. BLM helps from time to time. So. It depends is kind of the answer. Right now that we have the two permanent partners from DHS as part of, because we are the Fusion Center and that's part of what DHS supports. We also have outside partners that do also are co-located with us. We have partners from the National Guard. But overall, if the number of people in the office, I would say we have, with our outside partners, nine.
Ish.
Depends.
Today.
Depends.
On a good day.
So here are the key responsibilities of the Fusion Center. Information sharing again. I mean, all of this at the root of every function we do is some level of information sharing. The Terrorism Liaison Officer Program, there's Investigative Support Services, there's the Urban Area Security Initiative, and the Critical Infrastructure Program. I'm going to go through those different responsibilities and discuss them in greater detail. So information sharing is one of the critical functions, and we share information on a daily basis. And this kind of information we're going to share is we might get a law enforcement tip to be on the lookout for a particular suspect that a particular agency is trying to identify. That may or may not be just Oregon. We can get that from Washington or from other jurisdictions. I've got some good samples of that. You have people that are trying to find somebody, missing persons, attempts to locate. A good example of this that I find particularly compelling, you might recall the Pedersen-Grigsby homicides. There were four homicides in three states, so two in Washington, one in Oregon, and one in California. And the Oregon Titan Fusion Center issued a BOLO, a Be on the Lookout, for the suspects. California Highway Patrol officer got that and saw that and then went out on patrol and came across the suspects and was able to apprehend them. And what's key about that is not just the fact that the officer is able to apprehend them, but the other important part of it from a law enforcement perspective is that officer safety issues, that the officer knew who he was dealing with and what the threat that was involved in that particular encounter, which is absolutely critical. So, and lots of times you'll see here, like a BOLO could also serve as an officer safety alert. Those would be situations in which it could be a federal law enforcement partner, a state law enforcement partner identifies a different type of weapon. Maybe what's a flashlight is actually turns out to be, could be used as a firearm. Those types of tips and different trends that we're seeing is stuff that we'll report on. Same thing with situational awareness. A lot of this information that we share is kind of trend-based. It's not going to be specific-based in terms of specific suspects, although there will be exceptions to that or examples that are different than that, as I'll explain. But a lot of it will be situations in which maybe an event is coming up, a particular parade or some about a movement, then maybe there have been other parades of similar of a similar movement in other parts of the country. We can get information from our federal partners, maybe the FBI, some information about what to maybe expect for local law enforcement. We can get information from other fusion centers to know what they actually encountered when they were dealing with some of this. We can be prepared. Kind of more of a background information that's helpful, like field analysis reports come from DHS and the FBI, so that might be information about different tactics that people are using, and maybe it could be a new way of building bombs. So if a police officer encounters somebody during a traffic stop and sees something that would otherwise be innocuous, but now because they've seen the bulletin, they realize it could be part of a way to build a bomb, that might be something that they would say, go back to the fusion center and say, hey, look, I saw this on this day. I don't know if it means anything, but just FYI, I saw this in the person at a traffic stop, just so you can be aware. And then that's really what's why the fusion center is so important, is because we can take that information, and to that individual officer, that's just one little tiny piece of a puzzle. But that could be the one last piece that the investigative agency needs to make the case, to really put it all together, and that's what's so critical. Industry notifications, again, is when we're working with our private partners to kind of make them be aware of the various threats that they might face, and so that they're aware and they're observant and they're sharing information. And the weekly bulletins are the information that we get generally from tips and leads from law enforcement throughout the week, and that we get from other fusion centers, and then that we put together into a bulletin to send out to law enforcement. We really try hard to make sure that it's relevant and pertinent to the work of the people that we're sending the bulletin to. We don't want people to be inundated with information that's not helpful to their work, because then they'll start to tune out what they're receiving. And so that's why it's critical that we really work hard to screen that.
In information sharing, you have industry notifications on sub-bullet for DHS, FBI. But in terms of critical infrastructure, and in terms of, we'll just take entities like the utilities have their own security folks, they operate dams, Corps of Engineers, BPA, and those, how much of this information is shared with the security entities with inside the private and the public sector? Because those are, of course, wider eyes and ears than anything we can all fund. How much of what you have on here is shared with them?
Chair Boquist, Chair Evans, committee members, so there's different classifications of information. So that's sensitive information that's not classified. So in the sensitive information, you have law enforcement sensitive information, official use only information. So we won't share with the private partners the law enforcement sensitive information, but we would for official use. So they're vetted partners, people that we've worked with. And it's not likely that in that situation we would share specific information in terms of an investigation. Like if JTTF has a concern that, you know, there's a utility that is threatened by a particular group, but we would share information with them about general trends. Like we're starting to see this is a particular issue. There's a particular threat to this type of utility, and it could even be from a natural issue, or it could be any kind of threat. So it's more of a threat trend or things that we've seen nationally, as opposed to specific information about a specific threat.
Follow up. Sure. Mm-hmm. I just want to make sure I heard you right. I think I understood what you said, but not what you spoke, and that is in the JTF, for example, if my assumption, because it's the purpose of the fusion centers, is if utility X had a dam someplace and there was a belief that a terrorist entity might try and attack that dam, that is the sort of stuff you would share with that entity so that they could be on the lookout, so on and so forth, correct? Is that what you were saying, or are you doing
Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, committee members, you won't like this answer, but it depends. It depends on the classification of the information and how we have that information. It would depend. And so I'd hate to – I would think in many circumstances we would, but I can envision circumstances where we wouldn't. And usually our role in that capacity would be to share the information with the relevant investigative agency. So if it's the JTTF, then we would give that information for them in that kind of situation. Say, for instance, we got a specific suspicious activity report about that dam that was – enough for us to say we need to move now on that kind of information we got at the JTTF, we would defer to their judgment in terms of how we alert in that specific investigative circumstance.
Follow up. So I'm just trying to parse the middle here in an example. I mean,
the goal is, of course, to prevent something from happening in public, not prosecuting the case. So I'm looking for, I understand it's all situational, everything's situational, but I'm looking for the comfort zone from your entity that, I mean, the goal here is obviously if there's something going to happen, you want to prevent public endangerment. In that aspect, even if it's generic, versus saying, oh, let's just wait and see and we'll track these people, and when they do it, the problem is human nature always takes an impact. So my concern is the preventative nature and preventative public safety versus prosecution. We've had this discussion, so that's where I'm going.
So Chair Boquist, Chair Evans, members of the committee, yes, definitely. So the one of the factors, obviously, that we would have to consider is the how imminent a threat is. And so that would be something if it's an imminent public safety emergency, then we would take any reasonable measure we could to protect public safety. And if that meant we're in that circumstance, we alert the private partners, absolutely we would do that.
Right.
I think a protocol generally would be to get it to the JTTF, and if it's an investigative process, but maybe it's not. If it is that kind of situation, then yes. But it would also, as I mentioned, depend on those specific circumstances. But if we would do what we felt in that instance was in the best interest to protect public safety. That is, as you're pointing out, our key function at the end of the day is to protect public safety.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Here's an example I wanted to share with you that I find particularly compelling about the Fusion Center. So this was a rape at the Port of Portland. What the Port of Portland police had to go on was a video picture of the suspect and a description, and wanted to be able to identify that suspect, obviously. So we sent that bulletin out at the request of the Port of Portland nationally, and you can see kind of from this slide, Port of Portland sends in information to us and says, hey, we need your help. We need to find out who this person is. It's an imminent public safety threat. We send it out, and believe it or not, we get it goes out to the different fusion centers. So Massachusetts, North Carolina Fusion Center gets that. They distribute it out to their folks. And Colorado does the same. It's detectives in those jurisdictions who see that information, identify the suspect, and then directly call back the Port of Portland and get him. And that's why this is such a critical. Who would have thought in Massachusetts, North Carolina, or Colorado? But that's how. What's also I found particularly compelling is how invested the people who participate in the Fusion Centers are in making sure they get that information and they're reviewing it and acting on it. At the Fusion Center, we have the Terrorist Screening Center, which this is where the FBI has identified through has reasonable suspicion to believe that a person is engaged in terrorism activity. There is an Oregon nexus for that individual, and through this screening center, they reach out to us and ask us to assist in developing, a profile or other background information on the suspect to aid in their investigation.
I'm just looking at your screen and the numbers.
So you can see that those requests have increased dramatically in 2017, and the trajectory is that they'll continue to increase significantly, those requests from the FBI. So the Emergency Coordination Center, we call this the HISN network. So we have the Oregon Situation Awareness Room and the National Situation Awareness Room. This is basically an online network. And so think of it this way. If there's a national event occurring, like an inauguration, or there's it's a holiday, or there's some other events representing a particular movement that's going across the country, our partners can get onto this network, whether it be national or Oregon, and get instant timely updates about what's going on. And so you can think of a situation in which you hear from Massachusetts and other places on the East Coast that they're seeing certain activity, criminal activity related with otherwise would be a First Amendment protected activity in support of a particular movement. We can start seeing some of that information coming through. And if we have similar events here, we can kind of be aware of and think about what are we seeing. So if you see somebody with black hoods are happening or they're wearing a particular shirt or somehow identifying themselves, we can let our local law enforcement know to be on the lookout for somebody like that, because this is, looks like something that's happening on a national scale. So the terrorism liaison officer program is a critical component of the Fusion Center. This is really where we rely heavily on our local partners to help to advance our statewide and national public safety initiatives. And so what our office does is we reach out to local law enforcement and train them about how to be observant about terrorist and criminal activities, and remind them that we are the place to come to when you see something suspicious. Because that, again, is a kind of a part of what the Fusion Center is about. You, if a, if an officer is out somewhere and sees something suspicious, that officer needs to be able to know where to know what to do with that information. And we want to do the best we can to reduce any friction in getting that information to us. If it's hard to do, maybe it doesn't get to the right place. And so we try to do what we can to make that as easy as possible. A lot of those things, a lot of that information comes in, we refer to suspicious activities reports, we report those up to the FBI for further investigation. Sometimes we can get reports, they can come from people calling our office maybe, any way you can think of that the information gets to the Fusion Center, then we find out who should have that information, refer it back out to an agency for further follow-up if it's not the FBI, if it's something that we want other partners in the Fusion Center to be aware of, to be kind of on the lookout for, we can do that as well and send it out and distribute it generally. If you guys seen anybody taking pictures of dams recently, that kind of thing, we can reach out to see. And then that's when we start getting the information back. Now we start building a picture about what's going on based on one tip or maybe a couple tips. We have the investigative support services section. So largely up till now, I've been talking a lot about our information sharing functions. We also have investigative support services, which is basically analytical support for criminal investigations. And basically what the analysts will do is take information related to, well, here we can see financial, communication, or evidence, and kind of help put the pieces together to build a case through information charge, graphic visualization. And the analyst that we have now, we just have one currently in the Fusion Center that is trained at doing this, is she does very great work, and I actually have a good example for you to kind of walk you through a case.
Question on that. So when you say one analyst, at one time, I don't know that it was executed, but it was discussed having National Guard intel folks as a part of the staff to try to help out. You have one analyst, and is there the capability of having National Guard analysts to support this, to help this?
Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, it depends on, with this particular functionality, I'm not aware, and Steve's writing a note for me, that I'm not aware of a situation in which the National Guard analyst has helped with this particular type of work.
Could they? Legally?
I don't see why not. It would be up to, so I can tell you this much, that in terms of the National Guard right now supports the HIDTA task force across the state with analysts, they could. I couldn't see a reason why they could not support us with an analyst to do this type of case work in our office. Okay. Whether it meets a particular need of the National Guard, I'm not sure. Here's the example I'd like to share with you, though, about how compelling this evidence can be. So we had a former Tualatin Hills Park and Rec patrol officer who set multiple fires on park property, and he would return to act as if he were the hero. And as I think all of you know, that one compelling piece of evidence is cell phone location evidence. So in this case, we were able to use his cell phone location to say that although you said you were over here, your cell phone tower records actually show you're actually right around where the fire was. And so I'll show you a slide here of what she put together. So here, I don't have a great pointer for here, but I think you can see here where he claims to be fairly far from where the actual incident occurred. And then we can show up here that his phone was pinging off towers or all around where the fire was set. So that's the type of work we can do. We can take maybe a data dump from a seized phone and try to identify connections between different people to help develop investigative leads, that general kind of work. The Urban Area Security Initiative is a federally funded position. This funds one analyst for the UASI area, which is the metro counties up here, Multnomah, Clackamas, Washington, Columbia, and Clark counties. This position is sort of a jack-of-all-trades position. So this particular analyst is responsible for assisting in disaster preparedness and works with local law enforcement, emergency management, and private sector partners in fulfilling that mission. She does threat assessments. She does basic, like the casework I just spoke about for those counties if they need it. She's particularly skilled at human trafficking and financial crimes because that fits the particular need that they've asked for up there in the UASI area.
Question, Chair.
Yep,
is this one of the Homeland Security grant positions?
Chair Boquist, Chair Evans, members of the committee, it is indeed, yes. And the other Homeland Security funded analyst is Ms. Marhein sitting next to me, and she's is the coordinator for the Critical Infrastructure Program. And one thing we're particularly proud about is that we just recently, in March, got signatures for the Oregon State Infrastructure Protection Plan, which is within the 16 sectors that Ms. Marhein mentioned earlier, is that it's an agreement and a commitment by the state of Oregon to work with our private partners to do the best we can to protect the resources, the infrastructures that we have in the state. It's signed by the governor, the attorney general, and the adjutant general. The Critical Infrastructure Program also does threat assessments, and so that kind of assessment, it could be, again, on a location, it could be the Capitol, it could be a courthouse, it could be a particular event, and it's identifying what threats might be presented at a particular event. We've done things, for instance, at the race across the bridge in Astoria, the Pendleton Roundup, Rose Festival. So we're looking for general threats. A vulnerability risk assessment is slightly different. It's looking at but where your weaknesses are in a particular structure. So for here, it could be something like you've got an unlocked door in the back of the building, or you've got particular plants or shrubbery that's blocking view that will be an easy way to get access, different things like that. We have also responsible for doing DHS data calls. So what that is when we work with DHS, we want to share information with DHS, and we want to do our best to identify critical infrastructure in the state, because the more critical infrastructure we identify and the importance it is to national security, the more money we get from DHS so we can continue to do that good work. So we participate in these data calls to share that type of information, and that's essentially it. The more critical infrastructure we have, the more support we get from the federal government. We also work in particular work groups. So CIKR is another acronym. You cannot get through a Fusion Center presentation without lots and lots of acronyms. So this is critical infrastructure and key resources and cybersecurity work groups. So I think, as you're probably familiar, cybersecurity is kind of an emerging issue that we all have to be focused on and thinking about and what that means. And so we're working on that with various work groups so that we can do what we can to be prepared with the resources that we have.
Question,
yep.
So are we prepared?
Chair Boquist, Chair Evans, members of the committee. That's a difficult question to answer because it's a difficult question. It's a difficult area to identify fully the threat. I can tell you that we are working toward that with the resources that we have, but I don't know that I can add more to that.
Sure. Since this is a classified program and the legislature can't know who's in it, how do we know what critical infrastructure is?
Chair Boquist, Chair Evans, members of the committee, some of it's classified, some of it's not classified. In terms of if a legislator wanted access and had a need to know access for classified information, it's possible we could do that. The difficulty, as you know, with classified information is that the person who hears it, that's where it ends. There's not much that you can do with the information once you learn it unless you can share it with other people or have.
My understanding is all the entities that are involved in this, that they're even their names, that they're involved in the program becomes classified. Therefore, the problem is how does the state prepare for statewide infrastructure protection if we don't know what to do? And it's not the task of the Department of Justice to go do that emergency preparedness.
I'll
Do you want me to take that?
I'm going to defer to Ms. Marahine. She wrote me a note that I can't quite read. So.
Sorry. I type more than I write. Chair Boquist, Chair Evans, committee members. The critical infrastructure program, the critical infrastructure list that includes those items that have risen to the national awareness, that is a secret list, and that is kept in a secret room, and you can only go in that room to view it, and it can't be shared. That's correct. The program itself, though, is not secret. The program and the folks that are partnering with us in the program, that's very much unclassified. That's more of a for official use only type sensitivity. It's not actually classified information. So our partners, perhaps like the private sector partners we're working with, we can talk about those folks as long as they're willing to be a part of work groups and things like that. Does that answer your question?
Not exactly.
Okay.
Okay. You can't protect the infrastructure if you don't know what infrastructure you're going to protect. You're not going to get the legislature to give you more money at the same thing. So therefore, it is a weakness in the program across the board. Whether you know it's a nice list or not, the question is, I mean, let's be very blunt. Even the state police don't have access to the list, nor does the National Guard have access to the list. So the question then comes down, oh, gee, what are we going to do? And it is a serious weakness of the program all the way across the board, because you have to be able to plan and budget, you know, dollars to be able to apply to that particular area. So it is a huge problem. And the good news is there's more people on your list because we passed a law in which we have made them libelous. And so that's why more people are willing to come forward, because fuel infrastructure, for example, which I won't go into much detail in, but in the fuel infrastructure, they would not participate in our discussions for more than a decade until we passed a law, which then bluntly, everybody suddenly realized that, hey, what all common sense told you, there's not a gazillion gallons of fuel sitting around in Oregon. Suddenly everybody realized that there's not, you know, millions and millions of gallons of extra fuel, and we decided we should do something about it.
Sure.
But the problem is this particular program is seriously siloed, and we are seriously endangering Oregonians because of that. So
may I add to that answer? Chair Boquist, Chair Evans, members of the committee. The critical infrastructure program itself is it is a coordinated program. The CICARE work group that Michael mentioned earlier, our three prime agencies are the Oregon Military Department, the Oregon Office of Emergency Management, and the Oregon Office of Department of Justice. So we work very closely with those departments on critical infrastructure, those agencies, and our secret classification. So if we do a briefing and it's secret, the Adjutant General is involved. The director of the Oregon Office of Emergency Management is also involved in that as well. So just on that piece, we are sharing that with those agencies. Now, the program itself, even if it's those 11 assets, and I can tell you there's 11. I just can't tell you who they are. There's 11 assets that are on that national list. There are hundreds more that aren't on that list that are part of this program that we're working to protect today as well. So those are the ones that we're focusing on with our private partner, private sector partner folks.
Well, I'll just make a correction for the record, because since I've talked to two of the Adjutant General and the Superintendent of the State Police, I would say there's a slight difference of opinion not to be discussed further in this room.
Okay, sure.
And, Representative Bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is for Michael. So do you work with the PENWER Cybersecurity Center program, or it could be for anybody, I guess?
Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, we do, but I will again defer to Ms. Marahine to explain in greater detail.
Sure. As part of the cybersecurity work group effort going on, which we have partners from Port of Portland, different state agencies, local agencies, those kind of folks working on this effort, we've met with PENWER to talk about doing several events in the state of Oregon, similar to what they've done in Washington and Idaho. Mm-hmm. We even went and I participated in the Idaho version of some of their cybersecurity work groups, which were brilliant. They did a great job. I could say nothing but nice things about PENWER Group. They do really good work. So we're working close with RDPO, the Regional Disaster Preparedness Organization in Portland. I know acronyms. So we're working with those folks to plan something for Portland area, just to see if we can get the kind of participation that Idaho and Washington have gotten through PENWER. And it was a great, great workshop.
To follow up?
Yes.
So, I mean, then you probably know about the summit coming in July. Is there any chance that you could connect with that at all?
Chair Boquist, Chair Evans, Representative Boone, committee members. Yes, we'll be attending that summit, and we'll be working closely with our regional DHS infrastructure protection partners. They're going to be hosting a panel at the PennWAR Disaster Summit. So we're very much looking forward to it.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions before we... Okay.
So I wanted to conclude the presentation. I apologize. I'm not sure where we're at on time, so I hope we're...
Ooh, we've got time for a couple more slides and about three or four more big questions.
Okay. So here I wanted a final slide to highlight some of the key contributions of the Fusion Center as it's sort of beating a drum here about the importance of information sharing. We have many examples we can share of success stories, but simply stated, we've aided directly in the identification and apprehension of criminal suspects, which is in advance of one of our key objectives. These suspicious activity reporting, again, I believe is to be a critical component of the program. There has to be a place where people out in the field, one, they're trained to be observant, to identify threats, either through our particular training or the information we have already shared with them, and then have a place to take that information so they know. They don't have to think through, is this BLM? Should this really be FBI? Is this DHS? I'm not really sure who it is. They just know one place. It really reduces the friction, so we get that information, then we can pass it on. In the counterterrorism effort, this is the TSC, again, the acronym. I have the Terrorist Screening Center, do a blank on that. This is, again, the analysis that we provide that helps the FBI in their investigations of identified terrorist activity. And then, again, another key component of it is this infrastructure program that we have been talking about. So that concludes our prepared presentation, but we're certainly happy to answer any questions that the committee has.
Yes, sir. Mr. Lightwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I appreciate all this information, and I understand the value. You know, I'm trying to understand, though, in the case of a threat or that, I'm trying to understand how quickly or who ultimately decides then to react or do something. You've gathered it, you shared it with lots of different organizations in that. So is there a decision point or not a decision point? You gave the example of different fusion centers being notified and the information going out. So who along that course decides that there's an actionable item and something needs to be taken?
So Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, Representative Lively, if the information is coming to our office and it's coming from a particular, I mean, it's hard to think of, I have to try to think through examples of that might help shed light on your question. Largely, whether or not we're going to take a particular action is going to depend on the imminence of a particular threat and how we're going to do it and how we're going to monitor and follow up to make sure that it was followed through with. So there's different threats or different things that maybe we hear something about. I think of a situation that's happened like this, but I'll turn to my colleagues if they have. But if you had a instance in which you had an informant describe something's going to happen tomorrow, and so that would be incumbent on us to make sure that we had the adequate resources to address that particular threat if we can verify and validate that threat. So we would be working hand in hand with the individuals, and the extent we are a law enforcement agency, we may be engaged in taking action in that capacity depending on the threat. If something is a more remote kind of a threat or less of a vetted threat, then we would take whatever I think reasonable actions the circumstances dictated.
I appreciate this work. I think it's very valuable. I'm just trying to understand from the public's perspective, though, as we read about incidents and events and things, trying to understand the real value in all this work, and is it doing something, whether it's preventing events or responding quick enough. I'm trying to understand for them that read it and understand that all these things are going on. So where's the connection there that ultimately is making things better, I guess, rather than just we know information and we respond at that point? And maybe you're not even the group who does that, but you've got all these partners, whether it be the Homeland Security or FBI. Because the public in general doesn't have a lot of confidence that we're anticipating events and that we're just responding to after they've already taken a place. I guess that's my...
So Chair Boquist, Chair Evans, members of the committee, Representative Lively, there are different kinds of threats that we may be facing. So there's the imminent threat that you're talking about, and then there is information that is of a future threat or a particular trend. And so what the value of the Fusion Center, again, is to kind of at its base, what it was initially created for was in recognition of the need to share information. And so I shared with a few examples about how that happens on a more basic crime level, but it is a nexus by which individuals, trained law enforcement officers or trained observers out in the field, can identify something that's suspicious, and then again, as I was mentioning at the end there, know who to report that to. And again, that can be that one piece of the puzzle that's missing from making a case, making an investigation generally. So I would say in terms of an imminent response to something, we could get that information, we would act on it and get it out to our partners to help on it. Then there's the general gathering information, adding value to that information to identify particular threats, and then sharing that with a relevant partner. So that could be in an investigation. So if I'm talking about a threat or an investigation, it could come to us. We could share it with the JTTF, who may not be aware of something, and then they take action on it. Or it could be an event-type situation in which we allow different entities to know where to deploy resources. And so it is kind of one of those functions which, as the 911 Commission identified, is this critical information-sharing need. But it does happen behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Right, so we can bring up examples, and so what is hard to sometimes measure in terms of success are the thwarted efforts. But I think what we do know is that we are at an extraordinary disadvantage if we don't have the ability to share that information in a meaningful sense, and that's where we ended up with, at least from the commission of the 9/11 report, is a contributing factor to that type of catastrophic event. Mm-hmm.
So I have several questions that I want an answer today because time is getting short, but for our next conversation, which will likely be sooner than later. The first part is I want to get down to know why I happen to believe that when people have skin in the game, they're a little more active in making sure that it's used appropriately, and given some of the disconnects that can't be talked about in this room, I want us to find out why the National Guard doesn't have analysts in there, and I want to fix that and get them in there. So that's just one thing. Second thing is on the information sharing. I think there are widely different opinions right now about who is and who isn't getting access to the super secret room, and I don't care who gets access to the super secret room, except that somebody somewhere needs to be able to put information into a meaningful narrative so we can actually make sure we're investing in the smart places as opposed to the not so smart places, because that's just, there's a word for it I won't say here on why we would be putting money into things if that's not the one that's going to cripple us faster than something else. Third thing that I really appreciate us getting back to is on that piece. I absolutely understand that the tactical real-time value of what you're doing for law enforcement, I think that's very clearly demonstrated in the cases you bring forward. My concern is less about catching people than about preventing contagion and killing people necessary to be killed before they start a terror event. I understand laws need to be followed, but I also understand that there are some federal tools that are potentially available or information from those tools that may be available to help make sure that we get citizens out of an area if there is a threat faster. And this disconnect in many ways between a law enforcement centric approach, which again has a value, is to me more tactical. The strategic value is making sure that it's not just about law enforcement, that it's also about contagion, it's also about health alerts, it's about natural threats. The things that sometimes, because of the way in which money flows for grants, create the silos where people aren't communicating. I want to make sure that there's an oversight to that, and that leads to my last point. The Oregon Homeland Security Council, which we're looking at trying to revamp, was originally designed to make sure that people at the senior level, that the governor was getting the information that they needed. I think we need to revisit the role of that organization to ensure that the process is working to get the governor what they need. Homeland Security Council doesn't need to know everything the governor knows, but does need to make sure that the process is delivering information to the governor in a timely fashion to prevent possible preventative actions. Okay, so those are the things that, for the next time, I appreciate talking about.
My list is actually shorter. So we've had the discussion before that chiefs of police and sheriffs have raised eyebrows in the last 18 months about the success or failure of the Fusion Center. And that's a relationship that we have to mend. And I think it's a relationship, and this is a question here for you to get back, is that you have five positions, and two of them are funded from Homeland Security, which is a preventative organization. Homeland Security is a preventative organization from the 9/11 Commission, versus the FBI on the opposite side, which is a prosecutorial organization. And virtually everything, unfortunately, you said, counsel, was when something goes awry, you go to the JT, the Joint Terrorism Task Force, for the FBI, and very little was said about going out to the Curry County Sheriff's Office, which is sitting next to a very large IT facility in which information can be stolen from. And so you're also aware that legislative counsel in this building has said that your organization that you just briefed is, in fact, not a law enforcement agency, and doesn't fall into the category. And so we sort of have to deconflict that going forward to figure out what's the best way to protect the citizens of Oregon. And, you know, I think the legislature is most interested in prevention and not so much in the prosecution of how it works. But we have to sort of deconflict those, because chances are, madam, the grant is likely not to come in, because we're already facing those. And so it's the legislature that's going to be asked to backfill the two grant positions from Homeland Security. And the question is, what is their value, and are we really sharing information out to the local law enforcement at the dam you raised? Is there a problem? And that's sort of the questions to be resolved, because it is a constrained funding situation both at the state and the federal level. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator, questions? Well, thank you very much for coming forward. I know questions are coming from left, right, and center, so I appreciate that. Bottom line is...
One thing.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think one thing we want to be assured of here is that you have, and I'll use an example, you have Marion County, and you have three different hot spots. That you're taking care of all local people to be involved in that, to let them know that. I think that's the thing I need to be assured of, because, I mean, what good is your organization if you have somebody next door to you building a bomb and you don't tell the police department? So.
Go ahead.
Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, and members of the committee, if I could clarify that, if my comments were too narrow in particular to Representative Escobar, your concern you just raised is that is absolutely part of the Fusion Center's mission, is to get that information out to the local law enforcement partners as much as it is to the FBI. So to the extent I suggested it was just the FBI and not our local law partners, then I misspoke. If we had a situation in which there was information that was relevant and pertinent to the Curry County Sheriff or the Marion County Sheriff, we would do our best to get that information in the hands of those partners.
But with the one analyst, right? You've got one person putting this together. You've got different functions overseeing different programs. How many folks are actually putting the puzzle together on any given day?
Chair Evans, Chair Boquist, members of the committee, that is a challenge the Fusion Center faces, is that we do have one analyst. But I might defer to Mr. McIntosh, if you could clarify on the role of the current role of the National Guard in the Fusion Center.
Chair Boquist, Chair Evans, and committee members, I'm Steve McIntosh. I'm an assistant special agent in charge at DOJ, and I do supervise the Fusion Center over the entire analytical unit. Currently, we do have two representatives of the National Guard in our analytical unit. They are assigned as part of the HIDTA group, and what they normally work on and what they're concentrating on is the financial side of narcotic investigations. So they're chasing the money. I'm not sure if under the National Guard they would be able to put someone on the intel side, that's up to somebody at a much higher level than I. But we would most absolutely welcome them into our Fusion Center to help out.
Please do the research on that, or if we could move in that direction, because the lines between civilian and military roles, the National Guard is generally seen as the tool that can play in both worlds.
Absolutely.
And I want to utilize that capacity, because the ability to put together a picture effectively, seems to me, is at least as important as a system built to collect and distribute the information. But if you're truly staffed at a point where you find out 2 hours after you could have actually saved people, that would probably not be best. And that's not on you. That's on a staffing question of what do we actually need to make this as useful in all areas of hazard as possible.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd just point out, because we get emails all the time, that the National Security Agency that everybody talks about in the news last week in the Oregonian, they collected 151 million records on individuals with only 42 warrants, actually is the Department of the Defense. The National Security Agency is a agency within the U.S. Department of Defense. And, of course, that material without a warrant cannot be utilized for prosecution. But obviously, there's 151 million records on different individuals last year in the United States. They collected a whole bunch of preventive information that would have been quite useful for local law enforcement. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for sharing your afternoon,
and
look forward to future conversations.
Thanks, sir.
Thank you.
We're going to close the House Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness.
We'll close the Senate Committee. Thank you. Close the Senate Committee. Thank you.
Veterans Emergency Preparedness.